Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 22nd of June, these are our main stories. The search for a missing tourist submarine in the North Atlantic is widening, as estimates suggest those on board could run out of oxygen in the coming hours. The UN Refugee Agency has warned that the civil war in the west of Sudan is fast becoming an ethnic conflict. Lasers have revealed an ancient Mayan city in the heart of the Mexican jungle. Also in this podcast,
we're all brought into this world and sort of immediately indoctrinated and put in a box and told how we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to act.
A top Hollywood star on gender identity and redefining masculinity. In the waters off Newfoundland, rescue workers are searching into another evening and then on through the night for the tourist submarine Titan that's been missing since Sunday. An international search team has been assembled using specialised planes and boats, remote-controlled robots and sonar listening equipment, which has detected noises under the water. The five people on board Titan are likely to run out of air in the early hours of Thursday. Captain Jamie Frederick of the 1st Coast Guard District gave an update from Boston in the US on the rescue mission a few hours ago.
When you're in the middle of a search and rescue case, you always have hope. That's why we're doing what we do. With respect to the noises specifically, we don't know what they are, to be frank with you.
Michael Armstrong is a correspondent for CBC News Canada. He's in St. John's, Newfoundland. And tell me more about the challenges for rescuers.
It's about 26,000 square kilometres. It is a massive, massive area. The U.S. Coast Guard says it's about twice the size of the state of Connecticut. So it's just gigantic. But add to that that it's about 4 kilometres deep. So it's a three-dimensional search that they're doing. They've got both the surface area to search, and they've also got underwater to search.
And in terms of the equipment that's coming in, this is very much an international operation, isn't it?
It's pretty incredible, actually. There's a ship on its way from France at the moment. The U.S. obviously has a couple of boats that are there as well. I'm sitting in St. John's, and we've watched ships leave the harbor here last night, this morning. The latest one, an icebreaker, the Terry Fox, headed out to the site. They've got 5 ships there now. Another 5 are arriving in the next 24 to 48 hours. So very much just a huge operation out there.
And obviously, on everybody's mind is the fact that the hours are ticking by and the oxygen levels in this craft are definitively running out. What would you say is the mood amongst the people you've been speaking to there, the rescue operation?
Yeah, this is, I'll tell you, to speak to people here in St. John's, everyone's waiting for news, hoping that it's good news. But everybody knows that the clock is just ticking down. It's a frightening thing to think about. As a matter of fact, really, there are only 2 potentials here. One, that they're stuck underwater and can't be found. That's frightening enough. The other possibility would be an implosion. And that's just horrific to think about, too.
And Newfoundland itself is obviously a deeply maritime community, used to dealing with shipwrecks and maritime disasters. So it's a part of the world that, it, to a certain extent, is used to this kind of activity.
Yeah, you know, speaking to people down in the harbour, they said that very much the people here in the past used to wait for ships to come back, hoping that everybody came back, that sometimes it was sealers, sometimes it was fishermen. They have had horrible disasters also in the water, one in the 50s that were, I think, 80 people died in one horrific event out on the water. So it's happened before, and it's happening again.
Well, for more on the current rescue efforts and the technical aspects of that, I've been speaking to our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos. I asked him how they've been using those underwater sounds to help their search.
Well, there's a number of ways that you can find stuff on the seafloor. You can use sonar to sort of kind of map the seafloor, right? You can look for stuff. Very difficult because there's rocks. You know, the seafloor goes up and down, and this is the Titanic, right? There's a lot of debris down there. So that's difficult. Sound may be the best way to find this sub. Now, we've heard about these bangings, these knockings. Let's be super optimistic, right? Let's suppose that inside that vessel, these five individuals are banging on the metal ends, these titanium caps that they have at the ends of this particular sub. They do it in a time-intervalled, patterned way, and then that allows the search forces at the sea surface to put down sonar buoys, listening devices, and a bit like GPS, you know, which is using radio, timed radio signals, to locate a position. You use the arrival times of those sounds at the listening devices to triangulate where the source of that sound is coming from. But here's the crucial point. They need to narrow the search area. They really do. And the reason for that is these ROVs that they put down, they move slowly. They don't whiz around. They move at walking pace. Now, if I say to you, search this 1 kilometre box, okay, and you're at walking pace, even on the surface of the Earth, that's difficult, right? And we're talking about a window that is rapidly closing. So by my calculation, at around about 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, GMT, the expectation is that the oxygen in that sub is going to be very, very low, if not exhausted. So they have tremendous time pressure against them to get this done in any way they can.
Jonathan Amos there. Well, for the first time since contact was lost with the submersible, we've heard from the company that owns its mothership, the Polar Prince. Sean Leet is the co-founder of Horizon Maritime Services.
We are very aware of the time sensitivity around this mission. Our crews and onshore team are experts in their fields and will continue to support this effort in every way we can. We remain focused on contributing to the search for the Titan crew and continue to hold out hope that they will be located and brought home safely.
Well, it's now emerged, though, that safety concerns were raised about the submersible 5 years ago by a former employee of the company. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, has more.
OceanGate's deep-sea submersible, the Titan, has some unusual features. Its hull, the part where the passengers sit, is made from carbon fibre with titanium caps at each end. Carbon fibre is used in aeroplanes and yachts, but not for deep-sea vessels. It's extremely strong, but questions have been raised about its reliability under extreme pressures. The shape of the sub is also different. Most have spherical hulls, so there's the same pressure all the way around. But the Titan is tube-shaped. This is so it can fit five people inside, but it means the pressure isn't equally distributed. In 2018, safety issues were raised by an employee of OceanGate, David Lockridge, an experienced submersible pilot. In American court documents, he said the structural integrity of the Titan had not been properly tested, and this could subject passengers to potential extreme danger in an experimental submersible. Concerns were also raised by engineers from the Marine Technology Society over the experimental approach adopted by OceanGate that could result in negative outcomes from minor to catastrophic. An OceanGate spokesman told us they couldn't provide any information at this time. Subs that carry passengers can go through independent safety assessments by specialist organisations, but the Titan was not certified by any external agency. In a blog post in 2019, the company said its design fell outside the accepted system and that simply focusing on classing the vessel does not address the operational risks.
That was Rebecca Morell. The civil war in Sudan has been raging for almost 3 months, and now the UN's refugee agency has warned that in the western region of Darfur, it has fast become an ethnic conflict. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, told us more.
So we heard from Toby Harwood, who's the UNHCR's regional director for Darfur, and he said in West Darfur, and particularly the city El Janina, it had turned into a tribal or an ethnic struggle between Sudanese Arabs and the more African Marsalite ethnic group, which is one of the largest and poorest tribes in Darfur. And he said the situation in the western region had become random, immoral, and lacking in any state authority. So it's like a failed state. And the United States State Department also said They'd estimated that 1,100 people had been killed in El Janina alone. And earlier the BBC talked to an activist in North Darfur, and he was sort of corroborating the same thing. He's saying villages are being burnt to the ground, people are being killed, houses being looted, women being raped, thousands of people fleeing. So it's really just a desperate situation, reminiscent of the genocide in Darfur 20 years ago.
Yeah, which cost hundreds of thousands of lives, didn't it? And Richard, I suppose across the rest of the country, perhaps the fighting isn't as intense at the moment. We're not getting the focus, but it is continuing in many places as well.
It is. So in the capital, Khartoum, and the wider parts of Khartoum, so that includes the adjoining cities of Omdurman and Bahri, a very imperfect ceasefire that lasted for 72 hours, that's ended. So it's gone back to the residents here, this perpetual soundtrack of artillery, gunfire, drone attacks, street fighting. And then in South Kordofan, which is in the south of Sudan, the paramilitary shelled a police station. And there's also fighting between the army and the RSF in North Kordofan, in the centre of the country, in the state capital, El Obeid.
That was Richard Hamilton. Now, could Ukraine's NATO application be fast-tracked? This has been one of the main questions at the Ukraine Recovery Conference here in London. And according to the UK's Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, they've shown that they're on the right path. But other NATO allies remain reticent. The BBC's diplomatic correspondent James Landell has more.
Joining NATO is not easy. Most countries have to go through what's called a membership application plan, or MAP for short. That's a formal process designed to ensure potential members meet the alliance's military and democratic standards. But it can take time, sometimes decades. So will Ukraine have to do this? Well, not according to the Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly. He said Ukraine was already meeting many of the necessary NATO reforms.
I think the UK's position would be very, very supportive if we moved on from the membership action plan, recognising that the offer to both Sweden and Finland didn't require that. And the Ukrainians have demonstrated their commitment to reform, the military reform required for NATO membership through their actions on the battlefield. And I think all NATO allies recognise that.
The French Foreign Minister, Catherine Colonna, also suggested Ukraine might not have to pass through the MAP mechanism. President Zelensky said Ukraine already belonged to NATO's security space and was waiting for alliance leaders to have the courage to recognise that. They were all speaking at a major conference in London, discussing ways of rebuilding Ukraine's economy before the war ends. Some countries promised Ukraine billions of pounds in support, but they know that won't be enough. Many speakers said Russia would have to pay for what it had destroyed, and private sector cash would be needed too. And for that, Mr. Cleverly said donors needed to see progress in reforming Ukraine's institutions, code for tackling corruption. What he and others here hope is that Moscow gets a clear message that the West is committed to Ukraine's long-term future, both military and economic.
James Landell. The Chinese government has reacted angrily to remarks by President Biden likening Xi Jinping to a dictator. Mr. Biden made the comparison just a day after the Chinese leader held face-to-face talks with the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. China's foreign ministry described the comments as an absurd and irresponsible provocation. From Beijing, here's our China correspondent, Stephen McDonnell.
After sending Antony Blinken to Beijing to prevent Sino-US relations from collapsing any further, in meetings which went for 7.5 hours at a time, it took only one word to undo all that momentum. Dictators. President Biden seemed to be trying to diffuse concerns over last February's Chinese spy balloon incident when, at a fundraising event in California, he equated China's leader with other dictators. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Mao Ning responded to the comments at a regular press briefing.
The remarks by the U.S. side are extremely absurd and irresponsible, seriously contradicting basic facts, seriously violating diplomatic etiquette, and seriously infringing China's political dignity. This constitutes an open political provocation.
Behind closed doors, the Chinese government can possibly factor in that this didn't appear to be a deliberate attempt to cause offence. But Xi Jinping is an all-powerful figure here, and anything which criticises him is viewed very gravely. It had been hoped that Mr. Blinken's trip might pave the way for a Xi-Biden meeting later this year. It's unclear if that will happen now.
Stephen McDonnell. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
This is the most violent episode of a mutiny in a female prison in a country's recent history.
At least 40 inmates are dead after arson and rioting at a women's prison in Honduras. So what's fueling the gang violence behind it?
Every weekday morning, wake up with an in-depth look at a single story that's affecting Africa right now.
And every weekday afternoon, wind down with three essential stories from across the continent and hear African perspectives on global news.
That's what you'll get from Africa Daily.
And Focus on Africa.
Two BBC World Service podcasts all about Africa.
And where will they find them, Alan?
Just search for Africa Daily and Focus on Africa wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In Tunisia, a journalist has been arrested for objecting to the government's decision to criminalise criticism of the head of state. Zid El Henny is being held by police over alleged crimes through telecommunications. That's according to his lawyer. He'd mocked an article of Tunisia's penal code on his morning show on a private radio station. The article punishes anyone guilty of insulting the head of state with up to 3 years in prison. My colleague Paul Henley asked the BBC's North Africa correspondent, Bassam Bweni, who's in Tunis, to tell us more about Ziad El Henny.
Ziad takes part in a daily radio programme on 91 FM, a private station. He has expressed his opposition to President Kais Saied since his power grab in 2021. He is a member of the National Committee for the Defense of Freedoms and Democracy, which is a local independent right group.
You describe this as a power grab. Tell us about the clampdown on the freedom of the press that's gone on in recent times in Tunisia.
Actually, there are more than 30 people behind bars on an array of accusations. And these detainees are politicians, journalists, now with Ziad El Henny arrested 24 hours ago. There are activists, there are social activists as well. And, you know, the situation is feared by many local and international NGOs as a backslide in a country which was a promising one with the Arab Spring over the last decade.
And tell us more about the president and the way that he runs the country.
Actually, the country is run by one person and only one person, who is Mr. Saied. The checks and balances that was one of the exceptional achievements after 2011 was removed and undermined by the constitution adopted last summer with a very little turnout, no more than 8.8% went to cast a ballot. Now that the Tunisian president is leading alone, the country is still struggling to escape its social and economic plight, plus the fears of the backslide.
Tunisia was an important setting for the revolutions of the Arab Spring movement. What is the state of public opposition there now?
Very weak, actually. And I can give you an example, Paul. On my phone, I keep receiving almost every day notifications mentioning that X or Y on my phone book are joining a more encrypted messaging app because people are simply afraid of being spied on. So even on the street, people took to the street many times after 2021. Now we have little expressions and manifestations of protest, including protesting against poverty, against inflation, against the unprecedented economic crisis.
That was Bassam Bweni speaking to my colleague Paul Henley. The social media influencer and self-proclaimed misogynist Andrew Tate has appeared in court in Romania for the first time since that he was formally charged with rape and human trafficking. His brother Tristan and two female associates also face charges. They all deny the allegations. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson sent this report from outside the court in Bucharest.
I believe in God and I believe in the justice system and we're going to be okay.
Andrew Tate was followed into court today by a frenzy of television cameras and questions.
How much money did you make from exploiting women?
Zero.
The hearing today was the first step in what is set to be a long, drawn-out trial. Andrew Tate's lawyer said the judge had handed them the indictment, all 370 pages of it, for them to raise any legal objections. It's likely to be months before the charges themselves are tried. Mr. Tate spoke briefly after the hearing and reiterated his innocence.
I want to give a very special thanks to Romania and the Romanian people. The number of Romanian people who send me messages of support is absolutely fantastic. This is my home. I love this country. I'm going to stay here regardless, no matter what. And I look forward to being found innocent in the end of everything.
His chief lawyer, Ioan Gliga, expressing his personal opinion to journalists outside court, said, even if the facts are as the prosecutor presents them, they are the least serious form of these crimes. A ruling on whether to keep the Tate brothers under house arrest is expected later this week.
Let's head to Honduras now, and a very grim story, one which the president, Xiomara Castro, has described as a monstrous murder. At least 46 people have been killed, the majority of them women, inside a women's prison during a clash between rival gangs. Well, the president accused the prison guards of complicity and has fired her security minister. It happened at the Tamara facility near the capital, Tegucigalpa. Relatives of inmates gathered outside the prison to demand news of their loved ones. This woman was amongst them.
We want to know who is alive, because they are human beings. They are our family. We want to see them and know how they are. If the authorities are silent, what are we doing here? Staying silent as well? No, we want answers. We want just one answer and to have our relatives out, not have them sleeping there. We feel the pain, as you can see. Maybe they are dead already and we don't know anything.
Well, Tiziano Breda is a researcher for the Italian Institute for International Affairs and former International Crisis Group analyst for Central America. He told my colleague Razi Iqbal what had happened.
The dynamic is still quite unclear. This tragedy seems to be a result of a fight between members of the country's main gangs, namely the MS-13 or Mara Salvatrucha and the 18th Street Gang or Barrio 18. During this fight, some inmates were killed through the use of knives and also firearms, and others were basically constricted into a room and then that was later set ablaze. That leaves the total death toll to over 40 people at the moment. The reasons that, you know, triggered this fight are still quite unclear, but definitely what we know is that this is the most violent episode of a mutiny in a female prison in a country's recent history.
The president, Honduras's first female president, Xiomara Castro, has expressed her shock at what she called a monstrous murder. What is it that the government can do, given that the picture you're painting is of a kind of replication of gang culture in society inside jails?
Well, it's very complicated for Castro because she came in on a platform that proposed to change the security policy in a way that would be more humane, more community policing based, more prevention of violence based compared to her predecessors, which came from the conservative right-wing National Party and basically insisted on a more law enforcement and kingpin strategy based policies to tackle organized crime and the gangs. And in particular, she proposed to diminish the role of the military, who had taken on a very prominent role in public security, and give back the control of public security to the police. But probably this police was not yet up to the task in controlling jails, which are in a status of complete overcrowding, almost 200% of overcrowding compared to their capacity, which are plagued by widespread corruption among the prison officers for some bribery or out of threats by these same groups, often, you know, ease the access of weapons, drugs, cell phones within jails. And the same happens at the local neighborhood level. So the problem for the government is one of capacity in the first place.
You alluded to two other Central American countries. Let's focus on El Salvador, which also is under a state of emergency, as is Honduras. But the way in which they have dealt with their prison situation and the gang culture, it has been different, and different for what reasons, and slightly more effective?
Well, there are several reasons that explains why it's been more effective in El Salvador. First of all, well, the country is more or less half the size of Honduras. It's very highly populated. It has not so many rural areas. So the topography of the country makes it easier, for example, for the police and the military to not to patrol the streets and the neighborhoods and the territory in general. Second, the number of security officers is, I think, double in El Salvador in the ratio of the population compared to Honduras. Third, the capacity issue, not only in terms of numbers, but also in terms of control of the prison system. In El Salvador, since 2016, some extraordinary measures were imposed that basically permitted the authorities to regain control and to hinder the communication between the leadership in jails and the rest of the gangs on the outside. And finally, the government of El Salvador has concentrated an amount of power that make it easier, so to speak, to fine-tune the action of the several institutions that need to be on the same page when it comes to fighting gangs. Bukele controls the legislature, controls the judiciary, and of course, has the security forces on his side. And that allowed everybody to basically follow suit the president's order, something that Castro is in no position to do.
That was Tiziano Breda from the Italian Institute for International Affairs speaking to my colleague Razi Iqbal. In a dense, previously unexplored part of the southern Mexican jungle, archaeologists have made a huge discovery. Thanks to new overhead laser technology, they found an entire ancient Mayan city, complete with columns, temples and ceremonial altars, all hidden amongst the trees. Experts think that this could have been an important centre for the region over 1,000 years ago. The BBC's Latin America and Caribbean editor, Vanessa Buschluchter, told me more.
The pictures that have been released are not showing that much in themselves because, as you can imagine, the vegetation has completely taken over. This is dense jungle, which is why the city or the remains thereof hadn't been discovered before. So you can see vegetation over stones and over columns that have fallen onto the ground. There's one picture where you can see the roots of a tree almost embracing this stone, which one of the archaeologists said was an altar. And there's others where you can see like a pyramid structure. The way it was discovered was that archaeologists worked together with experts from the University of Houston who have a laser that they can fly over the jungle, and that maps this area.
What are the archaeologists hoping to find when they actually get on the ground?
First of all, they want to take more tests of the ceramics and the pottery and also the soil that they have brought back from this site to pinpoint when exactly this city would have been inhabited. They have a rough idea and they think it is from the golden age of the Maya civilization in this lowland area of Mexico. So they think it probably would be between 250 years AD to 900 AD. But of course they want to be more exact. And in order to determine that, they will take samples and try to compare what they found with finds they've taken from other cities, which have been more studied already.
And Vanessa, what led to the end of this extraordinary civilization, the Mayans? It's shrouded in a bit of mystery. There are a lot of theories as to what brought it so swiftly to an end around about 1000 AD.
So many theories have been brought forward. There's, of course, cultural questions that there was a decline in these cities. There are theories that involve changes in climate, because when this Mayan civilization was at its heyday, there was a particular climate which propitiated this building of these huge structures and cities. So if your harvest fails, you can't feed your people, you can't feed your workers, you can't build those kind of cities.
Vanessa Bush looked at that. In 2020, Oscar-nominated actor Elliot Page announced via his Instagram that he's a transgender man, star of the X-Men series and hit films like Juno and Inception, as well as Netflix super hit The Umbrella Academy. Page has enjoyed the career heights actors could only dream of, whilst all the time being crushed under the weight of the secret identity battle. He's now released an instant New York Times best-selling memoir, Page Boy, and spoken to the BBC's gender and identity reporter, Meg Moen. She started by asking him what one of the themes in the book, redefining masculinity, means to him.
Gosh, I guess it means to me in so many ways about how, whether we're trans or cis or straight or queer, we're all brought into this world and sort of immediately indoctrinated and put in a box and told how we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to act, etc. And, you know, men in so many ways are encouraged to not be emotional, not share feelings, you know, being aggressive is encouraged. And of course we have toxic masculinity as a result of that. And I suppose for me, you know, I, for myself, being able to find my truth and authentic self and be able to exist the way I want to exist in the world, I hope that for everyone. And I hope in so many ways those expectations of what it means to be a man, what masculinity means, can also be redefined and healed.
How much of that noise do you listen to on parts of social media? The lies, the hateful rhetoric, the, you know, certain parts that use trans people for clickbait or as a political football? How much do you take in?
Well, I mean, if you look at the news, it's you can't avoid it. You know, you don't even have to go into the, like, social media sphere, which I do try and my best to just avoid. It's not healthy to look at, of course. But yeah, I mean, you have, like, mainstream publications and progressive publications that, you know, perpetuate these, you know, views that suggest that our lives are up for debate. There's days where I'm like, I actually just can't look at the news because I can't see another guy. I mean, I always want to stay informed and be, you know, aware and up to date on what's going on, of course. But there's also some days that are like, I can't, just for my mental health, engage with this harmful rhetoric.
How do you imagine acting in the next few years?
I mean, I feel, you know, more excited about acting than I have in a very, very, very long time. And I think, I guess that's the same way for basically everything right now. I'm more excited about everything because I feel so different in a way I never thought I could before. But even we just finished the final season of Umbrella, and just the difference on set and how much more embodied I feel. And I really just, I do feel like I'm really living my life for the first time.
Transgender actor Elliot Page speaking to the BBC's gender and identity reporter, Meg Moen. And that's all from us for now, but we will give you a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter, of course, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer and the producer was Lippa Capellan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Hello, Nairobi. Hello. I said, hello, Nairobi.
Hello. Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, and my BBC World Service podcast, Dear Daughter, is on the road. Here in my hometown of Nairobi in Kenya. It's the podcast where we share letters and stories and words of wisdom for daughters everywhere. And this is the second of two Dear Daughter live shows, the relationship special. So, you know what to do. Wherever you find your BBC podcast, search for Let's Do It Everyone. Search for 1, 2, 3.
Dear Daughter!